From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Ukraine gives up the lead on the Malaysian airliner investigation. The U.S. Secretary of State heads overseas again for the Middle East peace process. Will Afghan women be further oppressed after a U.S. withdrawal?
Security is so important for all Afghans and particularly important for women and girls. It's the key to allowing women to participate in public life, in government, in politics, in jobs, in schools.
And the International AIDS Conference has one goal, but many paths. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Ukraine has offered to give the lead in the investigation into the shooting down of the Malaysian airliner last Thursday to the Netherlands, the country that had the most citizens on board. The offer came as three forensic investigators from the Netherlands arrived on the scene in eastern Ukraine, the first foreign experts to get there. VOA's Al Pessin reports from Kiev.
The Ukrainian offer appears to be aimed at convincing Russia and the rebels it supports to allow the transport of the 272 bodies found so far, most of them waiting in refrigerated rail cars in a rebel-controlled town. Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk announced it at a news conference in Kiev.
Ukrainian government is ready to transfer an international investigation to our Dutch friends. Dutch side could lead the process of investigation together with the entire international community and Ukrainian authorities.
The proposal could break a deadlock that has left the bodies stranded in the town of Torez. Russian-backed separatists who control the area have refused Ukrainian and international requests to allow the train to travel to the government-controlled city of Kharkiv, 300 kilometers away. Yatsenyuk said 28 investigators from four countries and three Australian diplomats arrived in Kharkiv Monday morning to receive the bodies and arrange for their transport to a forensic laboratory in Amsterdam. He said that would provide for a more independent investigation. Meanwhile, the three Dutch forensic investigators arrived at the crash site and are working with a delegation from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. That delegation is on a human rights mission, but diverted to the crash area last week and has been documenting the situation. Its spokesman, Michael Butsurkiv, described the experts' initial efforts at the rural station where the railroad cars are parked.
The three cars with the body bags were open. They stepped inside the three cars. They had a flashlight. They had a quick look around, and they said that they were more or less pleased with the way the body bags are stacked and the temperature under difficult conditions.
But Butsurkiv said it took the investigators a day and a half to reach the area by road. The government says it's not launching any offensives near the crash site, but there were reports of fighting in the regional capital, Donetsk, 80 kilometers away. And Michael Butsurkiv says there are reports the rail line may be damaged, which could further complicate the questions of where the bodies will be sent and when. At the news conference, Prime Minister Yatsenyuk showed anger and emotion and used strong language, describing the separatists as drunks and bastards and saying Russia is on the dark side.
Together with the entire international community, we will bring to justice everyone responsible, including the country which is behind the scene.
Mr. Yatsenyuk said Russia is supplying, training, and financing the separatists. He called on Russia to stop, saying enough is enough. But he said he does not expect Russia to cooperate now after months of supporting the rebels and days of no help with the crash investigation. Aside from the issue of the bodies, Mr. Yatsenyuk called for the handover of all evidence collected in the area where the plane went down. Some of it was collected by locally based workers from Ukraine's State Emergency Service, but other material, including the plane's flight recorders, is believed to be in the hands of the separatists. Officials say the qualified emergency workers are doing their jobs as best they can, but their activities are controlled by the separatists. Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur went down last Thursday with 298 people on board. Western intelligence agencies say the plane was almost certainly shot down by a Russian-made anti-aircraft missile fired from a mobile launcher parked in a rebel-controlled area. They say their sensors detected a missile launch and that three such systems were seen being driven back into Russia shortly after the attack. Russia's military said on Monday it did not detect any missile launches in the area and alleged that a Ukrainian fighter jet was flying 3 to 5 kilometers from the Malaysian plane. Russia also denied supplying any weapon systems to the rebels. Pro-Russian militants initially boasted online about shooting down a Ukrainian military transport plane last week, but then removed the post. And the Ukrainian government has published audio recordings it says are the voices of shocked rebels arriving on the scene and finding the remains of the civilian airliner and its passengers and reporting the fact to Russian operatives. Al Pessin, VOA News, Kiev.
President Obama at the White House today called on the pro-Russian separatists to allow international investigators to carry out their mission in Ukraine.
You have international teams already in place prepared to conduct the investigation and recover the remains of those who have been lost. But unfortunately, the Russian-backed separatists who control the area continue to block the investigation. They've repeatedly prevented international investigators from gaining full access to the wreckage. As investigators approached, they fired their weapons into the air. These separatists are removing evidence from the crash site, all of which begs the question, what exactly are they trying to hide? Moreover, these Russian-backed separatists are removing bodies from the crash site, oftentimes without the care that we would normally expect from a tragedy like this. And this is an insult to those who've lost loved ones. It's the kind of behavior that has no place in the community of nations. Now, Russia has extraordinary influence over these separatists. No one denies that. Russia has urged them on. Russia has trained them. We know that Russia has armed them with military equipment and weapons, including anti-aircraft weapons. Key separatist leaders are Russian citizens. So, given its direct influence over the separatists, Russia, and President Putin in particular, has direct responsibility to compel them to cooperate with the investigation. That is the least that they can do. President Putin says that he supports a full and fair investigation. And I appreciate those words, but they have to be supported by actions. The burden now is on Russia to insist that the separatists stop tampering with the evidence, grant investigators who are already on the ground immediate, full, and unimpeded access to the crash site. The separatists and the Russian sponsors are responsible for the safety of the investigators doing their work.
President Obama speaking at the White House today. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is urging a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas in Gaza and pinning blame for the escalating conflict on the Palestinian Islamist group. He is visiting Cairo, Egypt, to further the peace process. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns is traveling with the Secretary of State.
His first stop will be to meet with the U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, who is in the region like Secretary Kerry, to try to get the two sides back to the November 2012 ceasefire, the last ceasefire between Israel and Hamas over Gaza. Unfortunately for Secretary Kerry and Secretary General Ban, that's decidedly more difficult. As you'll remember, in 2012, then Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood were instrumental in negotiating that ceasefire, especially given their influence with Hamas. The current Egyptian president, the former general Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, is far less sympathetic to Hamas. Hamas has no real relations, no representation really with the Egyptian government. So this will be far more difficult in Cairo than it was 2 years ago.
The United States has a long-standing friendship with Israel, but the relationship with Hamas, we're calling them terrorists. Is there going to be some room there for the secretary to maneuver?
There is not, and the U.S. designation of Hamas as a terrorist organization does certainly complicate the issue. It necessitates the secretary involving countries and parties that have influence with Hamas. Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian Authority president, would be one natural conduit for that, although President Abbas appears to have little influence over the Hamas militants who are sending rockets into Israel. So perhaps it will be more productive for the secretary to involve those Hamas supporters, Turkey and Qatar.
When the Egyptian proposal for peace was accepted by Israel and rejected by Hamas, there was word that the Hamas military wing had rejected it, while the political wing of Hamas might be willing to consider it. Is there a possibility that they could reach out to the political wing of Hamas instead of the military wing?
You could do that, but in reality, you know, having a ceasefire means talking to the people who are responsible for sending those rockets into Israel. So even if there was an appeal through some interlocutors to the political wing of Hamas, the question would be, could they deliver the militants who previously rejected that ceasefire?
The Secretary of State has long been trying to help resolve the crisis in the Middle East, long before it even came to this point where there was shelling going on and so many people being killed. Is there any optimism that he's going to be able to make a difference this time? And is this an open-ended trip?
Most of the Secretary's trips to the region are open-ended. So, yes, I can't say where we will go beyond Egypt, simply because we don't know. I would say there's no optimism that the secretary will be able to help bring about a ceasefire, simply because he's not yet on the ground and doesn't yet really have a sense of what the dynamic is. He's certainly been on the telephone, you know, these past nearly 2 weeks during the fighting, but that's far different from having consultations with allies and others on the ground in the region. He is it is a somewhat open-ended itinerary for the secretary to move where he thinks he might best be able to bring about a cessation of these hostilities.
VOA correspondent Scott Stearns traveling with the Secretary of State. Israel's air defense systems intercepted two rockets over Tel Aviv today, and overnight raids in Gaza killed several dozen Palestinians as fighting continued between Israel and Hamas-led forces in Gaza. VOA's Scott Bob reports from Jerusalem.
Sirens sounded in Israel's largest city, and residents took cover as Israeli forces said they intercepted two rockets from Gaza. Palestinian health officials said the death toll in Gaza surpassed 500 people overnight as Israeli forces continued to attack tunnels and rocket launching sites controlled by the Hamas group and allied militants. The Israeli military said its forces killed at least 10 Palestinian fighters Monday after they crossed into Israel through two tunnels. Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon said the Israeli government is prepared to continue its offensive in Gaza as long as necessary. He said there are forces that have not seen action yet but are ready to, and if necessary, he adds, we will call up more reserves to continue the operation for as long as it takes to bring quiet to Israel and remove the threat from the Gaza Strip. His remarks followed the deadliest day in the conflict. 13 Israeli soldiers and more than 100 Palestinians were killed Sunday. A total of 20 Israelis, including two civilians, have been killed since the offensive began 2 weeks ago. Hundreds of Palestinians have been killed, many of them civilians, during that time. Senior Palestinian official Yasser Abderrabu expressed Palestinian concerns over the continued fighting.
He
says everyone wants a ceasefire, but everyone also wants to make sure that we will not enter again a circle of war and siege. A ceasefire proposal by Egypt last week was reportedly accepted by Israel, but Hamas reportedly rejected it, saying a political solution was needed that would end the 7-year-old Israeli blockade of Gaza. Diplomatic efforts to negotiate a ceasefire intensified as U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry flew to the region. U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is already here. The United Nations Security Council, following an emergency meeting Sunday night, called for an immediate cessation of hostilities and expressed serious concern over the growing number of casualties. Israel launched the offensive after hundreds of rockets were fired into its territory following the murder of a Palestinian teenager near Jerusalem. The teen was killed several days after three Israeli youths were abducted and killed near Hebron in the West Bank. Scott Bobb, VOA News, Jerusalem.
When the United States completely withdraws from Afghanistan, will the Afghan women lose all the freedoms they have gained and revert to the oppression they were under during the Taliban days? Catherine Powell, a fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations, has written an article expressing her concern that they may.
My concerns are that we not withdraw too hastily before we've had the chance to train the Afghan authorities, their security forces. Security is so important for all Afghans and particularly important for women and girls. It's the key to allowing women to participate in public life, in government, in politics, in jobs and schools. And we've seen how since September 11th with the fall of the Taliban and the restoration of a democratically elected government and with a more secure environment, how women and girls have dramatically been able to increase their participation in public life. So my concern is that we not withdraw before those elements are in place that the Afghans can take up the role of providing adequate security protection and rule of law and institutions for women and girls to participate in public life.
Are you worried the Afghans may go back to the system they had before where women were totally shrouded and were not allowed to go to public on their own and little girls were not allowed to go to school?
Well, I do have a concern about that, and already we see in Taliban-controlled areas where Taliban insurgents have come back into power that essentially they are putting those structures back in place that are excluding girls or intimidating girls from participating in schools or that require that curricula be approved by them before, which essentially means that then girls aren't able to participate in schools. So we're already seeing that. And if the Afghan authorities aren't strong enough to keep control of the country, I am concerned that we could see a return to the Taliban, at least in some areas of Afghanistan, as we're already seeing.
If you could reach out there and change it, what would you say needs to be done in Afghanistan right now so that there are equal rights for women and men?
I think we need to see a continuation of opening up of opportunity for girls in schools, first and foremost. Already enrollment, girls' enrollment is 40%, which is tremendous given that there were virtually no girls in regular schools under the Taliban. But it's not half, and there needs to be continued improvement, and particularly for girls in rural areas. So that's number one, and education is the best economic development policy for the country. Number two is to ensure that women, including, again, women in rural areas, have access to jobs, all, including entrepreneurship, access to public and private sector jobs. And then third is the issue of security, which affects all areas, as I mentioned before, access for women and girls to public life. But security also in the home, including domestic violence. There's a new Elimination of Violence Against Women Act, but it hasn't been adequately enforced, and the parliament hasn't adopted it, so it was issued under a presidential decree. That's incredibly important for women and girls to feel safe
and able to participate both as equal partners in the home and to be able to feel that they are empowered to go out in the world and realize their fullest potential.
Catherine Powell, a fellow for women and foreign policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. Tuesday, we will hear about her blog on preventing Afghanistan from becoming another Iraq. People at this year's AIDS conference agree on one basic goal, eradicating the deadly virus. But Anita Powell found out on the sidelines of the meeting, experts and activists have vastly different visions of how to get there. She brings us this report from Melbourne, Australia.
AIDS is often called the world's smartest disease. Once inside a host, the 9-gene retrovirus replicates with uncanny speed, yet changes tack suddenly whenever the immune system tries to challenge it. The virus, which under a microscope looks like a little ball covered with spikes, has outwitted some of the world's greatest scientists, who have yet to find a cure more than 30 years after the virus was first recognized. The UN's AIDS organization says that in that time, AIDS has killed a staggering 39 million people worldwide. And so, as some 12,000 delegates, among them scientists, activists, and people living with HIV and AIDS, meet this week in Melbourne, everyone seems to have a different plan for neutralizing the virus that attacks on so many fronts. Many, like Nahat El-Hadi of the Sudan Family Planning Association, have a simple wish from this conference.
Ending new infection, HIV-AIDS new infection. All the science, all the posters, all the presentation, come on and work together to end new infections.
Others, like the head of UNAIDS, Michelle Sidibe, have a detailed step-by-step plan, which he outlined at the conference's opening ceremony.
My vision for ending AIDS looks like this. Voluntary testing and treatment reaching everyone everywhere. Each person with HIV reaching viral suppression. No one dies from AIDS or is born with HIV. People living with HIV live with dignity, protected by laws, and free to move anywhere in the world.
But as many activists point out, medicine is not the only route. Society plays a powerful role in the fight against AIDS, especially in societies where gays, lesbians, transgendered, and intersex citizens are ostracized or criminalized. This conference has made special note of that issue in its declaration, calling for an end to discrimination against those who are different. Abina Aher is one such person. She was born with a male name. She now lives as a Hijra, a person who is neither fully male nor fully female, in her native India, though she publicly identifies as female. Because Hijras are ostracized, she says, they often resort to sex work to survive, which in turn leads to a huge risk of AIDS. She says she sees a huge gap in the medical approach. If, she says, a person is so depressed that he does not care if he lives or dies, how can he be protected against HIV?
My priority is not HIV. My priority is feminization. My priority is social support. My priority is mental health. When you design an HIV program, you cannot keep away all these things out of that.
Researcher Kylie Johnston of the Australian Research Centre in Sex, Health and Society agrees.
I think the most important thing for me is that community doesn't get lost in the biomedical, because I think they have a lot to contribute still to the fight, and also we can get sort of caught up in the science and the excitement of things like the cure and, you know, treatment as prevention, but I think we need to make sure that community is still involved.
On the conference's first full day, Monday, there were 87 different scheduled events, and that does not include side events or exhibitions. It's a lot to think about, especially considering that somewhere in that enormous mental haystack, there may be that cure that everyone so desperately wants. Anita Powell, VOA News, Melbourne, Australia.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. There's a lot of things to do there, including listening to this program again if you like. Go under the Programs tab and look for International Edition. Thanks a lot. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.